So, well, I'm Eduardo, so I'm going to be teaching this with the help of Irini, who's not here yet, and Bindiya as well. Irini would be the TA for the course, and Bindiya is the PSI fellow at help us teach this as well. And I'm going to talk about quantum information. Now, doing a quantum information course for, let's say, a diverse audience of different backgrounds people is tricky, so one has to make decisions. So first of all, disclaimer, quantum information, it's more than I will talk about here. So there's a few select group of topics. Some of you I see, some faces that I know, that took quantum theory 3 with me as well. Well, there's some, maybe up to the half of the first board, you already know everything, because I did cover that in that course too. But I try to cover it here as well, to unify a little bit, create a common background knowledge, and then see a little bit of review of things with a different perspective for at least most of you, which is a more quantum informational perspective. I hope we have some fun. The way I teach this typically is a focus on discussion. In fact, the first time I taught it, I didn't even set a number of topics, and I said, well, let's see how far I get with how interactive people are and so on. But that's nice because I learned how much I can fit typically for an audience of typical PSI students. There's a lot of discussion, and that's great and encouraged. I mean, at some point, if discussion takes too long, maybe I'll say, well, we can talk afterwards, because I really want to cover all these topics. But discussion is very encouraged. Please do ask questions. This course is supposed to be no BS. By that I mean, there shouldn't be anything that should be derived within the course that, you know, like that you should not understand. There's very little faith required for this course. Everything would be shown, proven, explicitly given to you. And if something feels that you don't know where things come from, please do ask, because that's not supposed to happen in this course, okay? There's no faith. And the requirement, the previous knowledge requirement, is quantum mechanics. So you all know, or most of you have seen formal courses in quantum mechanics. That's the only requirement. At the very least, PSI students have, because you've taken those courses. So we're going to revisit some of the things you've learned at the beginning of the course, maybe from a different perspective as well. So that's the only requirement here. You should not. Maybe a little bit of relativity for some comments that I'll make. But there's nothing here that you should be having faith to believe, right? Everything should be proven. Everything should be evident. And if there's controversy, please bring it up. I love that. I love when there's discussions. Make sense? All right, so what am I going to do here? Well, this is a list of topics that the course will cover. There will be course notes that Irini has been putting a lot of work into preparing. Irini and I have been working on the notes a lot. Those notes will be published after every lecture, you know, with the content of every lecture. Now, another disclaimer, those are not notes that, you know, they're preliminary notes if you want. So read them with that in mind. Don't share them too much saying, oh, look what Eduardo and Irini wrote. Not yet. Their notes are still in preparation. I think they're good, but they're not what I would call final notes that I would publish for the general audience, right? So. More like private for us. Make sense? And of course, you can take your own notes as well. What are the topics? So the topics, we're going to begin with a little intro. That will be the first lecture I'll do today. Hopefully, full time to do it today. Notions of classical information. And the notion of classical information that will be the most useful for us is actually the notion of ignorance. And that's the notion that we will focus on, the notion of ignorance, understanding what it means to be ignorant in classical information theory. That's very important. Many of you may have seen it. Many of you may have not. There's no assumption you have seen it before. But we need to understand what ignorance is, right? So we will focus on that first. After we understand what ignorance is, because that is extremely important to understand the formulation of quantum mechanics from an informational perspective, we will review quantum mechanics with an emphasis on things that are typically not emphasized that much in quantum mechanics courses. So we will discuss a little bit about, the formalism postulates of quantum mechanics and the formalism of density operators to describe quantum mechanical states, paying a little bit more attention to quantum informational topics than a typical quantum mechanics course, but just a review of things that you have seen. That's what we do next, the next lecture. For the things that are a lot of review, I may project some things to be faster. But again, the speed should be controlled by you, in a way, by your interactions with me. Okay. Then, we're going to talk about Shannon and von Neumann entropies versus thermodynamical entropy. All right, this is a big topic, so there'll be a little bit of that. What is the four Neumann entropy and what relationship does it have at all with the notion of Shannon entropy that we will see in the first lecture? And the thermodynamical entropy, whatever that is, right? These are terms that are thrown around a lot sometimes, assuming they're all equivalent in many occasions. They're definitely not equivalent all the time. Maybe some of them are more equivalent than others. And we will discuss in what circumstances they are equivalent and they make sense together. Make sense? All right. Then we will talk about multipartite quantum system. Again, a little bit of review, because probably most of you have seen multipartite quantum systems in your quantum mechanics. But again, emphasis being put a little bit on things that we will need in this course. And then from there, we will start discussing entanglement. Entanglement versus classical correlations versus other things that we'll mention later. Entanglement is, I would bet that you haven't seen entanglement the way I will show you. Maybe not, maybe you have, right? But we will discuss about entanglement again from a more informational perspective, if you want. What does it mean? How do we understand entanglement after we formulate everything in terms of information theory, okay? After that, we will visit the EPR argument, and we will talk about violations of local realism, in particular violations of Bell inequalities, what they mean, how to interpret them, mention a little bit how different people interpret them. So if you ask somebody like me, my interpretation or what I would tell you would be different from, for example, somebody working in foundations in collapse models, right? And nobody is more correct than the other. So it's, again, when we talk interpretation, it's a matter of discussing the implications of those, right? And then see what seems more reasonable to all of us. So we will discuss that a little bit when we get to the point of violence of Bell inequalities, right? And what locality actually means for different people and what it means in the context of Bell inequalities violation. After that, we will discuss entanglement measures. How do we, okay, entanglement, once we understand entanglement, how do we quantify entanglement? That's the idea. That's a very non-trivial problem. I don't know if you know that, but it's a really horrible problem. Almost as horrible as it can be, as we will discuss. So measuring entanglement, quantifying, this thing is more entangled than this other. There's more entanglement here than here. It's gonna be tough. That I can promise you that it's gonna be tough. So we will discuss how people tackle these issues. After that, we're gonna discuss the notion of mutual information and quantum discord, although mutual information you will see before that because it will be present in one of your assignments, tutorials. But we will discuss a little bit the notion of mutual information, what it is. We're talking about correlations between systems, right? And the notion of quantum discord, which is an interesting thing that typically not many people have seen, which is perhaps another kind of quantum correlations that are non-classical perhaps and are definitely not entanglement. So we will discuss that a little bit, okay? After that, we will talk about measurements in quantum mechanics, extremely important from the foundational point of view, but extremely important from the informational point of view as well. So we will discuss measurements in quantum mechanics, and in particular, we're gonna discuss, and you will see these topics also in other courses, but again, with different perspectives. We're gonna discuss the most general framework of measurements. What is a measurement to begin with? Because it's, again, a non-trivial thing. And what is the most general framework that we postulate into quantum mechanics typically to deal with measurements? And after that, we will discuss what are the limitations, let's say, of quantum measurements. After that, we will take a little hike down the path of the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space. And I don't want to reveal too much if you have heard of that because I want to keep the suspense. But we will discuss the notions of entanglement and the fact that we're ignorant sometimes. Sometimes we cannot know things. What does that have to do with entanglement at all? And why is it called a church? Well, probably because it involves some kind of faith, I guess. We will discuss that. There will be some content about quantum channels and channel capacities, but that is, maybe I should point out that some of the things like this one you would learn outside of the lectures, and by outside of the lectures, I mean you will deal with them during tutorials, okay? So there's a finite amount of time that we have, unfortunately, finite amount of proper time that we'll have, unfortunately, so we will have to see those things outside of the lectures themselves. We will talk about quantum teleportation, as we will discuss, a protocol that uses entanglement as a resource. We will discuss dense coding. Dense coding will also be seen outside, like in tutorials. we will talk about the measurement problem. And I say problems. We will not talk much about the useful, we'll talk a little bit about the useful measurement problem in quantum mechanics, which you have probably seen and you will see in foundations as well. But we will see what happens when you want to actually do the best thing that we know how to do so far, which is quantum mechanics and relativity together in the framework of QFT. When you do that, the measurement problem becomes much worse, much more complicated and much worse. So we will see a little bit of that, of the measurement problem in the context of how does that integrate with relativity and relativistic description of quantum systems. Okay. You can't, this is gonna be a fun topic. It's one of my favorites. So hopefully you will enjoy it a little bit. You don't need to know QFT for this or match QFT for this, because the only thing that changes is the what are the algebras of observables, right? The something about the algebras of observables in a theory that is non-relativistic versus a QFT. And that has big implications about what the useful measurements that we use are. Now, after that, we'll move to the more algorithmic computational, if you want, part of the course. We're going to discuss quantum logic versus classical logic. So learn what are the, if you want, the elemental operations that you can do both in, like, when you try to build a classical computer, but mostly when you want to build a quantum computer. Okay, so we will see quantum circuits. We will learn the notation for quantum circuits and how to represent quantum circuits. We'll discuss about universal sets of gates, what is a quantum gate, how to build up and quantize, if you want, algorithms and things like that. In particular, for algorithms, we will see in this course two algorithms. We're going to, in depth, actually in full depth, if you want. We're going to say, well, full depth, make a asterisk for sure. But we're going to see Grover's algorithm in full depth. That is a search, a quantum search algorithm that works in a way that is very different from classical search algorithms. And we're going to take a look, and this one will be two tutorials, typically, Shor's algorithm. Shor's algorithm is complicated because, you know, the quantum part of the algorithm is just a tiny bit. The rest of the algorithm relies on the most efficient classical algorithm that we have to factorize prime numbers. This is prime number factorization, by the way, Shor. And the quantum part requires a little bit of, so to get there, you would require some number theory and so on. So instead, to prevent that from being a need for the course, we have a couple of tutorials for it. But you will see in depth the Shor algorithm. And maybe you need some faith only for the number theory parts there. But I think that's the only place that you should need a little bit of faith if you don't want to go to the number theory part. Then we will talk about quantum cryptography as well. We will see at least one protocol of quantum cryptography, in particular, how to secure, how to get advantage using quantum mechanics of, take advantage of quantum mechanical properties of systems and measurements. Measurements are important in order to make sure that a communication channel is secure and that a message being transmitted and is reliable. We'll see BB84 in detail, and we'll talk about other protocols as well. Near the end of the course, I'll want to show you an example of a relativistic quantum information protocol as well. That's the kind of thing that I do, relativistic quantum information. So we will see a relativistic quantum information protocol example, in particular one called quantum energy teleportation, which you may think is related to quantum teleportation. Not really. Okay, it's a different kind of thing. Quantum energy teleportation is a pretty cool thing, in my opinion, if you ask me. It was introduced by Masahiro Hota in Tohoku University, and it's pure genius, and I love this protocol. And it was only recently experimentally proven that this actually works, and it's very neat, I think. So we will discuss quantum energy teleportation and the implications. You know, they connect with things that are very fundamental, as to, like, well, in a way, is extraction. I mean, you can think of it popular science wise as extraction of energy from zero-point fluctuations of a quantum system. I think of field vacuum and so on, but you use entanglement, that the ground states of complicated systems are entangled, to make a measurement somewhere, send information somewhere else, and with that information, people know how to push the ground state to actually extract energy from it locally. Again, no violation of thermodynamic laws by doing that. No, so we will see that. I think it's pretty interesting, and it connects very nicely with everything we see in the course. Now, I have here another line of extras. We will have time, that's my hope, we'll have time for lectures of discussion, and maybe, depending on availability, maybe something about quantum ethics as well. We had that last year as well, and people liked it a lot. So that's pretty much the content or a summary of the content of the course. Any comments? Anything that you would really like to see? I mean, my answer can be no, but just to know if there's something in particular you would like to see. And I hope we have fun. Previous year, this is a much bigger class than it was last year, I think. Yeah, it's like more than twice, no? Or something like that, I don't know. But that means that discussion, maybe with the same level of discussion, will mean half the content. So at some point I may stop the discussion, but not stop. I don't want to shut it down. We'll say, well, let's discuss after class or a different time, okay? But don't let me tell you that. So please do ask things and discuss things until I tell you, okay? Any questions? None so far? Okay, again, I hope that we all like this course and have fun while we teach it. All right, so let's begin with classical information theory. Now, something that I like to say when I start saying these things is, and again, apologies if you already know this, but hopefully I know some of you do. Something that in popular culture is often said, right, is what is a bit, right? In popular culture, they tell you, well, it's the quantum of information. It's the smallest unit of information you can have. Things like those, right? You hear them. That makes me a bit uncomfortable to hear, because certainly a bit is not the minimum amount of information I can give you. I can give you less than a bit if I want. Everybody's happy with that? So for example, what is a bit? A bit is the amount of information that you get when you get a definite answer to a yes or no question. Like for example, are you coming tomorrow? Yes. I've given you a bit of information with that answer, correct? But I can give you less. I can give you certainly zero, but I can give you half a bit of information answering that question. How? Are you coming tomorrow? 75% probability that I do. Wow, you have more information than before. Before it was 50-50, before you ask, right? You have full ignorance, 50-50. You don't know. Your best guess would be 50-50. You are fully ignorant, whatever that means. But now I've told you, well, it's more likely than I can that I don't. Well, I've given you some info, right? And that's half a bit of information. So you can actually give less information than a bit, okay? By a probabilistic answer to a yes or no question. So there's no such thing as a quantum of information when we talk about classical information. Make sense? All right. So here's the thing. There were people not that long ago. I mean, long ago in terms of not that many human lives ago, let's say. Now we're wondering, can we actually see the notion of information is a bit fuzzy. What is information? What is knowledge? Is it the same information and knowledge? What about ignorance? Things like those, right? What is a good definition of information? Do you have any working definition of information that you can tell somebody on the street if they ask you, what is information? It's a difficult question to answer. And people, in particular when I talk about Shannon, wonder about this question as well. Say, okay, can I rigorously define a notion of information? What is information really? And then Shannon said, well, actually, yeah, what I can define, it's a notion of ignorance. Ignorance is actually easier to define than information. Now, for example, if you have a fair die, right? Like let's say 1d6, right? So you, the six faces, it's a cube. And then you know it's fair. How much information do you have about the outcome of throwing a die, right? Well, if you roll once, you don't have any information. Your information is the minimum possible. You don't know. The probability of any of the outcomes is 1/6, right? It's a homogeneous distribution over all possible outcomes. You're fully ignorant about the outcome. Agreed? However, if you have a loaded die and the probability of getting a 1 is, say, 90% versus the others, well, then you have a bit of information about the outcome, no? You know that most likely it will be a 1. Agreed? So maybe, so that you see that the distribution in this case is skewed. You got a 1 with a high with a high probability and then low probability of the others. So maybe the notion of ignorance somehow is related to how homogeneous, in a way, a probability distribution is. Yeah, question.
Sorry, I'm a bit confused with what you said before. So you said that if you ask a question, are you coming tomorrow, and then based off what you said, I'm not sure if I get it right, but no answer would be the same as if I told you 50-50.
Yeah, before answering the question, or no answer, right? You have the probability 50-50. The probability distribution, and this is an important thing that we will discuss in this course, what does a probability distribution reflect? A probability distribution for us will reflect your state of knowledge. So if you don't know, for example, if I put a black ball and a white ball in a bag and I tell you pick one, and I want to know what the state of your ball is, I can still do it. We do that in statistical mechanics all the time. I want to describe the color of your ball, but I have no clue what it is. What is the color of your ball? Well, the color of your ball will be described by a probability distribution, 50% white, 50% black. So before taking a look or asking you, or you give me information of the color of your ball, my best description of your state is a probability distribution 50-50. So you see, the probability distribution is reflected my state of knowledge about your ball. Make sense?
I see. So if I tell you 50-50, then I don't give you any bits because...
Correct. Okay. It's the same as I had before.
Okay. Sure.
But if you tell me, oh, it's white, you give me one bit. If you tell me 75% white, then probability that is white, then you give me half a bit, kind of thing. Make sense?
Yeah.
Or less than a bit. Okay. So Shannon wanted to quantify this notion of ignorance. And it's so beautiful what he did. It's so simple and so beautiful. Let's go through it. So Shannon said, by the way, everything that I'm going to write here is for a finite number of outcomes, right? Finite dimensional variables, if you want. This can be done in the continuum as well. It just requires a little bit more gearing and formalism and define better, more math, if you want. Not difficult. You're very prepared to do it, but I'm not going to do it in this course for time purposes. But everything that I'm going to say carries to the continuum, all right? All right, even though I won't do it in the continuum. So consider a probability distribution for a random variable X. So capital X is my random variable. I'll try to do serifs when it's capital. So this is the same. I did it on purpose. This is the same as that. The moment it has something big on above all this horizontal line means capital, okay, in my notation. And this random variable can take m values, x1 small x means the values, 2xn, with probabilities p1 to pn. So we have a capital P probability distribution, and pi, small pi, right, means, well, the probability of finding the value xi when you probe that random variable. If you do an experiment, if you take a look, if you roll the die. Make sense? So Shannon says, okay, how, Shannon wants to define a notion of ignorance and said, okay, first of all, I feel that the notion of surprise, and by surprise, I mean, how surprised are you when you see, when you actually check the value of the random variable, make an experiment, roll the die. How surprised are you about the outcome? See, for example, the idea of Shannon first is saying, well, if you are very surprised all the time, then probably you were very ignorant because you didn't know much to begin with. That's the very hand-wavy idea. I will rigorize it, very hand-wavy. If you're very surprised, probably you didn't know much about it because if I know for a fact what's going to be, I'm not going to be surprised. If the probability is one of getting a one, when I see a one, I'm going to be zero surprised. I had very little information. But then someone that says, like, well, not quite, because I can think, for example, of a loaded die that has a probability of getting a one of 96% and 4% of other outcomes. So if I get a one, I'm going to be very little surprised, right? But if I get a four, oh, I'm going to be very surprised. I went through all the problems of loading the die to get a one and I got a four, well, the probability was not zero. So there's a chance you get a four, right? And in that case, you're gonna be extremely surprised. You see what I mean? So maybe surprise alone just said like that won't work, but Shannon said, well, how about this? Let me call it like Shannon measure of ignorance. To begin with, without names. He says, well, I'm going to call it H, or reasons. X on that random variable is going to be, how about is the average surprise? Meaning like, sure, sometimes I'm going to be very surprised, sometimes I'm going to be very little surprised, but if on average I am very surprised, then I'm very ignorant. Make sense? So if you compute the average of surprise when you have a one 96% of the times, and a four, well, yeah, you will be very surprised when you get the others, but somehow that's going to be weighted down by the low probability of actually getting that four. I'm very surprised. That's the naive or intuitive idea, if you want. So the average of surprise, what does that mean? So that means, of course, you weight the surprise of the probability of getting, let me call it like that, xi, right? Well, let me just call it first the surprise of, because it's the random variable. Yeah, maybe I'll call it xi. By xi. Okay, which is the same, of course, as sum I, bi, surprise, xi. So the idea here is that, well, again, yes, to compute the average of a function, right, of a random variable, what you do is you weight it with the probability of getting the outcomes and sum of all possible outcomes, right? Now, so the whole point that Shannon said is that let's go with the average ignorance. This is a purely informational notion, huh? Because one of the magic things that will happen throughout this course is that we will see that this purely informational notion can be thermodynamical. What? That is supposed to be very surprising. Pun not much intended, but it came out that way. So the problem here, right, as we said, so the characterization of ignorance as average surprise, okay, has one little problem. What is this? How do you quantify the surprise of outcomes of if you want, you can think of probing of the random variable. Think of it as doing an experiment, right? Or a set of experiments, or rolling the die, or taking a look. Make sense? So the whole point of Shannon's measures of ignorance is to characterize this surprise function. And we're going to do that the way we do all these things when we try to rigorize mathematically a notion like ignorance. We have to provide reasonable axioms. Those reasonable axioms, we need to agree they're reasonable. And let's try to put together the minimal amount of axioms, or a small set at least of axioms that we need to impose to that measure of surprise some reasonability and see if that is enough to determine the measure. Make sense? That's what we're going to do. Any questions? None? Good. All right, so today's lecture is going to be about that, which is, of course, the same or equivalent rather than saying the probability of obtaining that. So what is this chi here? This chi here represent sets of outcomes of evaluating the random variable. So chi could be x3, right? But chi could be, well, I do two experiments and I obtain x1 in the first one and x4 in the second one. So it's the probability of obtaining x1 and x2 in two independent experiments. Or it could be a set of 10 of those looked at it together. Make sense? So this chi is any sets of outcomes of measurements. Of course, you can have surprise for not just one time that you check. You could be surprised that I rolled twice and I got a 1 and then a 6. What is the surprise of that? Make sense? All right. All right, so we're going to give some axioms here. Hopefully they fit. We're going to call these axioms, for reasons, the entropy axioms. So these axioms are going to be, what do we want from the surprise function in order for it to be reasonable? All right, so number one, I'm going to give you the axioms, and then we discuss if you find them reasonable or not. Okay? The surprise of set of outcomes, which again, remember, is the same as the surprise of probability, notation-wise, of a set of outcomes, is monotonically decreasing with the probability. Right? So the larger the probability of the outcome, the less surprised you'd be of seeing the outcome. Right? That's the idea. The idea is that, well, if this set of outcomes was already very likely and you knew that, you're not going to be very surprised. Like, for example, you have a loaded die with 96 probability of rolling a 1. When you roll a 1, well, you're not going to be very surprised. But if the probability was 4% of rolling a 1, you will be surprised that you roll a 1. Make sense? Okay, so I can formulate it a little bit more informationally. That means that the larger T, the less information you learn. From the outcome of the measurements. It's like, well, I already knew it was going to be a 1. No surprises. Makes sense? Does it feel reasonable, axiom 1? Good. Axiom 2. We want this thing to be always positive semi-definite. Okay, so the amount of, if you want, the amount of information that you learn from an outcome could be 0 or positive. Make sense? You would be either not surprised or surprised. But no, negative surprise makes no sense. That's another action we want. Make sense? Okay. So maybe let's write it like that. The amount of info learned from an experiment is either 0 or finite, positive. All right. Now, axiom 3. We're going to say that if you are not surprised at all about the outcome, if you're not even a little bit surprised, that has to be because the probability of obtaining that outcome was 1. In other words, if you already knew you are not surprised. Make sense, everybody? The only way that you're not going to be even a little surprised is if you already knew the outcome with full certainty. Make sense? Now, number 4. Number 4 tells me if psi is x1, x2, all right? So if I do 2 experiments and I want to evaluate the surprise of obtaining some value x1 in the first one, some value x2 in the second, okay? Which is, of course, the surprise of the probability of that happening, which is p1 times p2. The probability of obtaining x1 is p1, obtaining p2 is x2 is p2. The probability of obtaining both in independent experiment is the product of both. Make sense? Then this has to be p1 plus the surprise of p2. In other words, the information learned from 2 independent experiments should be the sum of the information learned in each one of them. Make sense? This property is, this axiom is very interesting because it's telling you like, well, if I do experiment one, experiment two, the surprise, total surprise should be the addition of the surprise of the individual experiment. Make sense? There's an interesting action. Do you recognize it? Have you seen it before? Maybe somewhere in a different field? No? Doesn't ring a bell? Let me put it in different ways. This thing has to be additive under multiplication.
Like in entropy algorithms?
In thermodynamics. When Maxwell and Boltzmann were rigorizing thermodynamical actions, right? But this comes from a different perspective, huh? Completely different. This is, there's no thermodynamics here, at least not that we can see, right? But it's suspiciously similar. Make sense? All right.
Sorry. It seems arbitrary that it's a addition. Why shouldn't it be some a bit more complicated function of S mu P1?
Well, because you want to your surprise to be quantified. So for example, imagine that you are surprised by the first, you do two experiments, right? And they're independent. So why the surprise should come? We are free to choose the action here, obviously. But what is a reasonable action? We are building it, huh? We are just, it's a building the measure, right? And then you say, well, the amount of information, keep in mind that we can think of surprise in a way. The more surprised you are, the more you learn when you see the experiment. And what this is telling you, this is two independent experiments. So because the two experiments are not correlated, then it needs to be the addition. It needs to be what I learned here plus what I learned here for a reasonable measure, right? Again, of course, you could have postulated something else, but this is a pretty reasonable, of all the possible options, arguably the most reasonable for this, for how to do the composition of two experiments that are independent. We can discuss if it is, but definitely for me it is. Make sense? All right. Now, these axioms, they're not fully independent. One of them, so you need to see if you're monotonically decreasing and definite, positive definite, right? You already know that the maximum should be achieved, the minimum should be achieved when probability is one. So if you know that probability is limited to one, these two already imply three, but it's very nice to get three there explicitly as well. Okay, it's gonna be nice for derivations. Make sense? So again, you can prescind of the third one if you want, but let's keep it there. It makes sense. There's a fifth one that I need, probably the most arbitrary of all of them. Let me separate it from the others. And let me write it in a way that maybe you won't like. This thing, all right, just su of p of chi should be a smooth enough function of p. So I also demand that this is not a crazy function. It has to be smooth enough. What does enough mean? Well, that depends on where you're applying this to. For us, we need it to be, I think it's enough to be class 2. Yeah, class 2 guarantees it for sure. I'm just trying to think if it's class 1 or class 2. Let me see the derivation. For our purposes, we're going to demand that it's at least class 2. But then again, this is a nice property. You don't necessarily need it, but to make it work in closed form and have a nice expression, you need some degree of smoothness of this surprise function with the probability. In a way, it's reasonable. I mean, you can always argue that things that represent physical or existing things, right, have to be smooth enough because the universe is typically reasonable. Things are smooth when we look at them, right? I mean, the whole general relativity is based on the notion that we have smooth manifolds, right? And they're representing well things that we see. So, sure, at least some degree of smoothness is not unreasonable to demand, no? I hope. Again, it's the least justified, I think, from the others, but something that we need in order to actually find closed forms for it. Make sense? All right. So we have all those axioms that hopefully seem reasonable. And then we can wonder, what is the form, if any, does any function exist that satisfies all these axioms? Make sense? So let's find it. So we begin from action 4. we get the surprise P1, P2. It's equal to surprise of P1 plus the surprise of P2. So we're going to manipulate this. The first thing we're going to do is take a derivative with respect to P1. We can do it because the function is smooth enough. So that's what we need for this derivation that is smooth enough. We're going to take derivatives. So derivatives need to exist. All right. So if we take a derivative with respect to P1, we get P2 subprime P1, P2 equals subprime P1. That's a typo, right? Because it's P2. I'm taking derivative with respect to P1. Make sense? Everybody? Happy? I sometimes use your state of happiness to see if I made a typo or something. Because typically when there are faces means that I did something wrong. Please, if you see, okay, here's a warning, right? Arithmetics is not my field of expertise. So I will definitely on the board make mistakes. When you find them, tell me. Okay, I'm sorry about that. I'll try to minimize, but it will happen. Yeah, question.
For example, I think it should be surprise of P1, right? Surprise prime of P1.
What, sorry?
You're taking derivatives with respect to P1, right?
Yeah.
So the right hand side should be surprise prime of P1, no?
No, no. It's the same rule, right?
No, the right hand side.
Oh, my bad. My bad. Yeah, it was good for the meeting. So, okay, I use your state of happiness for that because I make those mistakes all the time. Sorry. I'll try to minimize them, as I say, right? But it's a complicated semi-definite optimization problem for me. Okay. So the next step is we take a partial derivative with respect to P2. And if we get that, if we do that again, we get, let me just write it in the following, maybe I'll write it here. We get that su prime P1, P2 plus P2, P1. Right, su prime prime P1, P2. Equals zero. Okay. And that's why I need at least a second derivative to exist. Yep.
Where are these factors of P1 and P2 outside of SU coming
from? Oh, well, one comes from taking derivative with respect to P1, and when I take derivative with respect to P2, it gets out of P1 again.
I'm not seeing why.
It's the chain rule.
Oh,
right? Okay, perfect. All right, but appreciate the question, huh? I want these questions. Make sense, everybody? All right, so what we're going to do next is we're going to call this a new variable p. Or if you prefer, do it whichever way you want. You can make fix p2 equals 1. Or call a new random variable p, either way. Make sense? So if we do that, we get the subprime p. Plus p subprime prime p equals 0. Nice. So the nice thing about this is that this thing is a total derivative. So let's write it as a total derivative. This is the same as saying that p subprime p prime equals 0. OK? And now it's ready for integration. We can find surprise by integrating this equation. Make sense? So far, so good. So we integrate once, and then we get that su prime of p is some constant, kappa. Okay. Integrating ones. Oh, P, sorry. Make sense? So now we want to integrate again. So what you get is sub prime of P is kappa divided by P. So if you integrate again, you get that surprise P. It's equal to kappa log P plus some constant. Agreed, everybody? Everybody happy with that? Nice. So we found out that the surprise is proportional to the logarithm of the probabilities, and there's a couple of constants that may need some more analysis to fix. Make sense? All right. So now that we have this form, we're going to use 3. From 3, we know that C has to be equal to 0. Because 3, that's why I have it here, is very useful, tells me that if the probability is 1, this should go to 0. So the constant, the additive constant, should not be there. Make sense? Nice. So now from 2, we need the surprise to be positive semi-definite, because probabilities are always between 0 and 1. That tells me that kappa has to be less than 0. Agreed? To make it positive. It's the logarithm of something less than 1. That's going to be negative. Kappa has to be negative. Make sense? Well, let me write it here. Since log p is always less or equal than 0. Make sense? All right, so finally, we have that the surprise of p is minus log a p. So what I did, small p, what I did here is like, well, a multiplicative constant in front of the log, I'll reabsorb it in the base of the log, okay? Because again, any log times a constant is a log in a different base. Make sense? So basically, we found, let me just kind of semi-box this. That the surprise function, it's kind of interesting, right? Because the surprise function was something very abstract. It's like, how surprised are you about an outcome of measurements? But imposing some reasonability conditions on what it has to be, we actually found a pretty close form for the surprise function. It has to be the log of the probabilities. Agreed? We're going to choose a base for the log for this course, right? Of course, you're free to choose the base of the log. This is a freedom. You have 1 degree of freedom in this that satisfying all these actions, no matter what base of the log you consider here. But because we like bits for quantifying information, because we can understand them, well, in the sense that, oh, that's the amount of information that I get from a definite answer to a yes or no question, right? We like to use log 2 to measure everything in bits. Now, you can use a different base, and in fact, people do use different bases. Well, if you use the natural bases, people call those nits. It's way more difficult to understand them intuitively, because bits are way more useful. Not because they're the quantum of information, because they're not, but because they're more useful to understand, right? We use base 2. So in this course, I'm going to pick, we pick that the surprise function is going to be the minus log 2 of the probability. Okay? This is our choice. We can use any of them, and we choose 2. Because it's very convenient to use bits again. Make sense? All right, now we go back to H, and we substitute in the surprise, and we find out that the quantifier of ignorance of a random variable, this kind of entropy, if you want, or quantifier of ignorance, is minus the sum of pi log pi. Makes sense, log 2, because we pick it. Makes sense, everybody? So this thing, this function, is the average surprise. Given a probability distribution, is the average surprise over all the possible outcomes of the random variable. Make sense? And this average surprise quantifies our ignorance. Now, you can tell right away that there are bounds for what time is it? I'm just taking a second. Okay. So you can tell already that this thing is bounded, right? This thing, when is it going to be zero? Well, this thing is going to be zero if you have, when is it going to be zero? Well, reasonably, it has to be zero when you have full information, no? No ignorance. Mathematically, in what case is it going to be zero? Can anybody tell me?
Yeah? When all PI are equal to one.
That's right. Not all PI. One of them has to be, because remember, the sum of all PI has to be one. Okay, it's a probability. These are probabilities, right? Okay. So the only possibility of that being zero is when one of the PIs is equal to one and all the rest are zero. Make sense? In that case, you get that the Shannon entropy is zero. Is zero, exactly. Or Shannon entropy, I didn't give it a name. That this quantity is zero. So literally, if you have one outcome that will be obtained with 100% probability, of course you're not ignorant. You know everything. You know for sure the answer. Make sense? When is this thing going to be maximized? Can you tell me that?
All probabilities are equal.
Say again?
When every probability is equal.
Precisely. When you have a homogeneous distribution. When you have a homogeneous distribution, you get the maximum value for this quantity, which is precisely what you would expect. If I have a homogeneous distribution, I know nothing about the outcome. It's the monkey statistic, right? It's a monkey guess. Makes sense? Like if it's a binary distribution, it's 50-50. Makes sense. So this indeed is satisfying all the things that we desire for a measure of ignorance. And initially, this was not called an entropy. You know why it's called an entropy? You know, I mean, maybe you don't know that, but it's very funny. This, by the way, we call it Shannon entropy. Shannon was given a talk once. I mean, this you can, I'm going to paraphrase things, right? Because I don't remember the quote. You can Google it. Shannon was giving a talk, gave many talks about these notions, like defining a notion of ignorance. And in one of those talks, von Neumann was there. And von Neumann said, you should call this function entropy. And the quote is really, really cool, but I'm going to paraphrase the quote. Shannon said, why? Why should I call this an entropy? It's like, said, well, because in physics, people use these kind of functions, and they're entropies in physics. And you might as well use that name, because it might also inspire some people to make connections if there are any. So it was von Neumann who convinced Shannon to call this an entropy. He called it an entropy. After Shannon, people started calling it Shannon's entropy. People don't typically name their things. Other people, the community, name their things on their behalf sometimes. So not always, but if people are naming things after them, it's a bit nuts. Not sportsmanlike, I guess. After themselves, I mean. Anyway, not always. Sometimes it's not the case. I know some cases. Shannon entropy, right? So we found a very, very concrete notion, a very, very concrete quantifier of ignorance. Make sense? Everybody happy? I like this a lot because it's very simple and goes from something very abstract that what the heck is ignorance to something very concrete. Well, this tells you how much ignorance you have. Makes sense. The best things are when they're very simple to derive and they're very powerful conceptually. Certainly makes humans feel the best, I think. It happens in my case, for sure. So the question that comes to mind now is that this Shannon entropy, okay, it's a measure of ignorance. Is it related to thermodynamics? Let's put yourself in the shoes of von Neumann. Is it related to thermodynamics? Why would you say so? Well, I mean, some of the axioms here are very related to what Boltzmann and Maxwell did and others like Gibbs did later on. They were not talking as much. Well, Gibbs talked a little bit about probabilities and so on, but we're talking about, you know, volumes of phase space that you can cover with distributions of particles in different levels of energy. maybe it's connected somehow with thermodynamics. Maybe yes, maybe not. You wouldn't be probably surprised to know that the von Neumann entropy that we use in quantum mechanics and we will define, it's not coming from thermodynamics originally. It came from von Neumann, who attended Shannon lectures and discussed and said, ah, I can define a notion of Shannon entropy for mixed states in quantum mechanics. So literally, von Neumann was not thinking thermodynamics. Von Neumann, maybe. I put myself in the shoes of von Neumann because he's the one who said call it an entropy. But Shannon, when Shannon constructs it, is not from the point of view of thermodynamics. It's from the point of view of information theory. Make sense, everybody? Any questions? No questions? Okay, so then in that case, I might have 3 minutes. Maybe I can just talk instead of showing you. In the next lecture, we're going now to review the formalism of quantum mechanics with ignorance, if you want. So look at this, right? What is a mixed state versus a pure state? So in quantum mechanics, or in the regular formulations of quantum mechanics, there are two sources of, if you want, ignorance about the outcome of experiments, right? One could be, well, I have a quantum superposition, right, of two eigenstates of some observable, and then I don't know what the outcome will be until I make the measurement. I have a probability distribution over the outcome, right, because of that. But in that case, if you're talking about a state vector in a Hilbert space, you know exactly what the state is. You have zero ignorance about the state. Agreed? I know the state is this superposition and just this superposition. But you can have another source of ignorance, right? The source of ignorance that happens classically as well, which is, well, I have a black ball and a white ball in a bag, and you pick one, and I get another, and I need to find the color of your ball. Well, before checking the color of your ball, the probability is 50-50. Agreed? So that's a classical source of ignorance. So in general, in quantum mechanics, you can have both. You may not know what state you have because you're ignorant, but it is the state, whatever it is, you just don't know, so it's reflecting your ignorance. Equivalently, you're talking about an ensemble of states and you're picking things from an ensemble. Or it could be that you know exactly the state, but the outcome of the measurement is not defined deterministically. It's a probability distribution. So we want to compare these two things, right? We want to compare, if you want, a state that would be 1/2 with something like this. In both cases, this is the case where I have two balls in a bag, and you pick one and I take the other. This describes the state of the two balls. Agreed? It's a classical mixture, if you want, of probability 1/2, 0, 1, so black, white, and probability 1/2, white, black. Versus this one. This is, I know very well the state of the two balls is this one. I just don't know what the outcome of measurement is. But in this one, you have ignorance, in fact, full ignorance, about the color of the ball in this case. And in this one, you actually know exactly the color of the ball. It's this state. Make sense? It's described by that state. So we're going to talk a little bit about the distinction between these two things from the informational point of view. Interesting enough, right? In both cases, so when people talk, and this is a bit of a spoiler, when people talk about entanglement, right, popular science, that's something you should correct when you hear it. People will tell you, what is the crazy thing about entanglement? Well, the state of the balls is unknown, and then I measure one, and I immediately know the outcome of the other. That's magical. Maybe you're doing action at a distance or something like that. No, you also have that in this case. So imagine, you have a black ball, but you don't know. This is nobody has looked into it. And then I say, okay, imagine that I measure my ball and it's white. Then I know immediately that your ball is black. But I'm in Alpha Centauri, I don't care. I know already the outcome of any measurement that you do on your ball. And that's fully classical, there's nothing entanglement related about it. Make sense? So no, entanglement is not surprising because I can know the outcome of your measurement when I measure mine. That's called correlations, and it exists classically and quantumly. Make sense? So that's not what entanglement is, not at all. We'll talk about what entanglement is. Now, another thing before we leave, and that will be very fast, is a quick comment, or maybe we can discuss this instead. Like, what the question whether something is classical or quantum. I want to devote like 5 minutes to thinking about that, right? Because these things are often confused, right? What would you think characterizes quantum in opposition to classical? Any opinions? Anybody?
Fundamental uncertainty principle.
In a way, but here's the thing. Imagine that I concoct a classical theory. For example, the molecules in this room, classical molecules, right? Statistical mechanics, and then I tell you, and I add a notion of fundamental uncertainty, meaning telling you, your probing of phase space cannot be arbitrary. I'm imposing, on top of the classical theory that I have, I'm imposing a limit on your measuring devices, which fundamentally, instead of there's something I don't know that fundamentally imposes to these hard spheres that collide and bounce, I'm imposing that you won't be able to ever measure delta x, delta p with full certainty. If I do that, does it become quantum? It doesn't. So that cannot be it. Anybody? Oh, that's good. That's really good, by the way. Yeah? And it's not entirely wrong, but because in quantum mechanics there is a fundamental uncertainty, but that is not what makes it quantum. Anybody else that didn't take quantum theory with me, of course? So you see, nobody says anything, but typically people on the street would tell you, Planck's philosophy, no? Discrete energy levels or something like that, no? For energy, but that's also not true. It's neither necessary nor sufficient, right? You can have a Dirichlet cavity, classical electromagnetic waves in mirrors, right? And the energy levels there are quantized. And it's fully classical electromagnetism. Not all wavelengths would fit, if you want to say it like that. Energy is quantized. Also, you can have a free quantum electron, right? Very quantum, but free, moving in free space, continuum spectrum. No discrete energy levels. So that's not it either. So what makes quantum quantum? And that is actually a really good question. Different people would tell you different things. It's an opinion question. I have an answer that is objective. Not everybody would mean that when they say quantum versus classical. Because, for example, people would tell you the superposition principle is a quantum, you know, you can be. No, the superposition principle is a consequence of having linear equations. You have superposition principle with classical waves. If I want, I can interpret a probabilistic theory of classical waves as, oh, it's at the same time, one and the other with the same. I could do that. Nothing forbids me from doing that. So it's not quite that what makes things quantum either. Also, that's a basis-dependent statement. It would be very sad that. That's what makes quantum quantum, right? And a superposition is not a superposition if I switch different bases. So what would actually be the case that objectively makes something quantum quantum is the inability to actually describe it with a classical probability distribution over phase space. If you are able to describe the theory with a classical, with a probability, forget the word classical, with a probability distribution over phase space, then there will always be a hidden variable theory. Like, you can understand the theory, oh, there's fundamental ignorance, sure, but there's some, I can actually have a model that has values with, you know, and this distribution is just your ignorance. You can always do that. If you cannot represent quantum states as probability distribution over phase space, then that state is very quantum. And that's literally what happens. I mean, I have a full course about that. It's called Quantum Theory 3 at the university. I'm not going to talk about that. But that's what makes quantum quantum, right? Inability to represent it and as a probability distribution over phase space. And one other thing I wanted to mention is that you have a problem with quantum theory, a big one. And I just mentioned this, and I won't talk much about it unless you ask. There's a big problem with quantum theory. How do you do quantum theory? If you look at how are quantum theories built, quantum theories are built typically in two ways. And there's no more ways. Way number one. I have a classical system, I have a classical action, and I go through something called the quantization map, canonical quantization. I put hats, I associate to every dynamical variable a self-adjoint operator that represents it, and I transform my Poisson brackets into I h bar commutator, or minus I h divided by h bar commutator, right? The other one is path integral. You can get, again, a classical action, and define your quantum path integral by introducing a phase in your classical action. Now, there's a big problem with that. And the problem is that there's actually a theorem. You can ask, under what conditions can I quantize a classical system? Under what conditions can I go through the quantization map? And the theorem tells you, Gren's Wald theorem tells you that actually only in one very weird case. In general, you can. You might as well say you can't, actually. It's not well defined. The process of quantization is not well defined. Mathematically, a mathematician would tell you, you cannot really do it. And you already saw problems with that. You already see, you know, let me give you something. Imagine that you have a harmonic oscillator. This is just for fun. Imagine that you have a harmonic oscillator, right? Something like that. That's a classical harmonic oscillator. Okay? And now I want to quantize it. What you typically do is this, no? Canonical quantization. All right. And did you say this is the quantum version of the harmonic oscillator? Let me give you another one. What is your least favorite function in the world of the closed form functions that you know? Give me a function that you wouldn't like to see in a Hamiltonian.
Sine.
Sine. I'm going to do a hyperbolic sine. Let's keep some room. F, x to the power of 5 times p to the power of. Maybe I'll do the cosh, you know, in case somebody gets really picky. To the power of 7. If you add something like that, certainly it's not the same. It's not gonna behave. It's not gonna behave like a harmonic oscillator anymore. No, it's a weird potential. And I can also add this I commutator of xp. This thing is I h bar identity, right? This thing, if you want. When I take h bar going to 0, what does that become?
0.
No.
No, the classical.
The classical harmonic oscillator. So which one is the one we should pick? Why is this one better than this one? They're the same classical. They come from the same classical Hamiltonian, you see? Why is one better than the other? Why is just the recipe of putting hats to the classical thing what we do? Yeah?
Is there symmetry?
It is. That is actually why. It's called the Weyl quantization, and it's the one that is symmetric. I agree. But why? What's the physical reason? Like, for example, if my classical Hamiltonian is, say this, xp. That's my classical Hamiltonian. Says that. What is the quantum one? Well, you would say, well, maybe in this case, we symmetrize, right? I mean, you have to, because otherwise it wouldn't be self-adjoint, right? Agreed. But why not this? Let's do this. P. Why not that? Instead of that. That's also self-adjoint. In fact, infinitely many ways of splitting this. That gives me something that corresponds to the same classical Hamiltonian. Agreed? So there's actually, it's not well defined. The quantization map is not well defined. And this is a consequence of it. Now, what we do, in, as you say, we pick one. There's two people that looked into that long ago, Weyl and Bigner and others, and said, well, this one is nice. Why is it nice? Well, it's symmetric to begin with, and we like symmetry. Also, if you quantize this, the exponential of lambda x plus mu p, you just put hats. And that's kind of nice because, you know, kind of generating translations. The translation operation is just putting hats. So nice. But there's no good physical reason for it. Does it work in experiments? It works fantastically. Except for when it doesn't. Because there are cases where it doesn't. And we say, well, this is an anomaly. We correct with other terms. We have a term here that is not in the classical theorem, and we add it. But it goes to 0 in the classical limit. Sometimes you have to do that. Why? Well, why are you doing this quantization to begin with? You see what I mean? So there's a problem with that, right? So when we talk about quantum theory, we need to make sure what we mean when we talk about quantum. How do we go from classical to quantum? This problem, by the way, is a problem in canonical quantization, but it's also a problem in path integral formulation of quantum mechanics as well. It's represented a bit different there, but it's also present there. And those are the couple of things that I want to tell you as anecdotes that are relevant for when we make statements about quantum theory, but nothing else. And the next lecture is Friday, right? On Friday, we will review quantum mechanics, having all these things in mind, with an informational perspective. Make sense? Are you happy that there's no way to quantize things? You should be. What makes you clever, right? Yeah.
But technically, we shouldn't be expecting to like be unique map from classical to quantum.
There's none.
So I think a better way to put it is like we should learn how to write down things in a quantum way, right away.
No, you can't. That's the problem. The building of quantum, there's no way to write directly in a quantum way. Because how we build, so that goes to how do you build a theory, right? How do you build a theory fundamentally? You do experiments. Yeah. And with those experiments, you are informed about the symmetries of your problem. And with the symmetries of your problem, you postulate an action for that. So the way you build your theories is by writing actions, directly or indirectly. And those actions are not quantum, they're classical things. They're a reflection. The actions are reflections of the symmetries that you see in experiments. So you always start from a classical theory to build a quantum one. There is no way to build a quantum theory from scratch. No way. I don't know how.
Can I start from like Hilbert spaces and operators right away without referring to action?
You can, but then there's infinitely many ways of doing it that relate to experiments. Like there are different quantizations, right? And different ways to go back to experiments, because the results of experiments are only giving you symmetries, information about how your systems behave that will lead to an action. So that's not how we do it. What we do is keep in mind that we need to have a phase space first. So you never build from a Hilbert space. Even if you have a Hilbert space, that would be a Hilbert space representation of dynamical functions in phase space. So you will still have to relate them. We need a classical theory to begin with. We need something to begin with, to start with, an action, which is a classical object, and then a quantization map. You can set a path integral from the scratch. Still, a path integral relies on a classical action. So you always need to start from something classical. So it's not well-defined. We do use one map in particular, which is the Weyl quantization, as mentioned. It's the symmetric way of doing it. The one that maps products of functions of operators to symmetrizations of those. But that is an arbitrary choice. An arbitrary choice that works fantastically. Don't get me wrong. Sometimes it fails. Very few. But works fantastically. But there's an arbitrarity there, right? There's no unique way of doing it. And we pick one, and it seems to work really well. And you should be uneasy about it. Yes, for sure, you should. So what is incompatible in Gren-Wahl theorem, I can tell you the two things that are incompatible, is the quantization map, which is mapping dynamical functions to self-adjoint operators, so representing a self-adjoint operator to dynamical functions, together with the map of the Poisson bracket to the minus I commutator. That is incompatible with finding irreducible representations of those dynamical variables. And you need them. Because you need the representations of those dynamical observables don't have different sectors where you can have one physics here and one physics here. Which one is the one you pick? So you need to be reducible as well to have a well-defined theory. And these two things are incompatible, except for one case. I think it's the cylinder. You can quantize the cylinder. Phase space. If phase space is a cylinder, you can quantize that. You also can quantize the Heisenberg algebra, as in like P and Q or an X, position and momentum and identity. These three things I can quantize, no problem. But functions of them, where they multiply each other? No. Anyway, that's it. Sorry, I didn't want to take your time that much. But we continue on Friday.